So the question here is, can you contain a breach and keep it to a minimum that you can recover from it quickly? And that's the whole ideology behind resilience. So once we shift the mentality to one that drives cyber resilience, naturally the fear of not being able to hit or get the 100% prevention benchmark is going to fade away.
This is KBCast.
As a primary target for ransomware campaigns,
is security and testing and performance and scalability.
Risk and compliance.
We can actually automate that.
Take that data and use it.
Joining me today is Ruben Koh, Director, Security Strategy, APJ from Akamai. And today we're discussing how to defend against cyber attacks on networks and systems. So Ruben, thanks for joining and welcome.
Thank you for having me, Carissa. Very nice to be here and very excited to share as well.
So Ruben, in your words, give us a little bit of a lay of the land. How do you see it when it comes to, you know, defending against cyber attacks on networks and systems?
Yeah, that's a very common yet interesting question at the same time. So if we look at what happened in the past year in 2024, we saw that the cybersecurity landscape had been incredibly dynamic, with attackers constantly evolving their tactics, with law enforcement stepping up their efforts to contain and control cybercrime activities, and also an increase in victims and, you know, more sophisticated attacks like ransomware. And all those have been just part and parcel of a very, very fast-moving or fast-changing landscape in cybersecurity. So, for example, what we observed last year was ransomware basically escalated throughout the year. And I know Australia had quite a few companies that were hit hard last year with regards to ransomware. And we believe that ransomware continues to remain a threat, a very big threat in 2025 this year as well, because we're basically looking at a shift in both techniques as well as players, as in the ransomware groups, even after multiple law enforcement takedowns, as well as improvements in data recovery mode, or rather data recovery made by traditional ransomware, less effective. We're still seeing victims falling to that and even paying the ransoms. And that's really happening even right now. The real issue for that is because ransomware techniques has kind of shifted a little bit. So in the past, we, you know, as a ransomware attack, we know that it's going to find our data, lock it up, and then basically ask us to pay a certain amount of money before they unlock it, or so they say. But what we're looking at right now is because of all these efforts by law enforcement and organizations becoming more savvy on dealing with data backup and recovery, we're seeing players moving into different technique where they only exfiltrate or they only steal data. They don't exactly encrypt it anymore because that's really no point. And when these attacks occur, it really hurts certain industries like healthcare and finance because data exposure for these two industries is, you know, the cost is phenomenal. Because you've got electric medical records that's, you know, going on the dark web for sale. You've got customer financial information being exposed, attracting fines, regulatory violations, and so on. And more importantly for the victims, it's really hard to ascertain if data has been stolen. It's easier to know if data has been encrypted because, well, you can't access it anymore. But if it is stolen or copied out, it's harder to tell. And we've also seen ransomware attackers publishing old or partial data claiming that they have successfully stolen everything. So some of those might be true, but most of them are false. They just, you know, we realize that most of these are just trying to take an easy way out. And more importantly, ransomware attackers have also been threatening victims with DDoS attacks or denial of service attacks or data leakage if they don't pay by a certain date. So we call these are commonly known as, you know, triple ransomware or double ransomware attacks on top of the initial encryption threat. So that's on the, you know, the fast evolving advanced attack, which is ransomware. Another observation that we had was we saw hacktivism in 2024 actually rose by quite a fair bit. So hacktivism in the past were usually, you know, associated with small little unknown groups that were really trying out or rather coming out and trying to make a point and make themselves kind of noticed by the world. But in 24, that kind of shifted a little bit because we started to see hacktivist groups that are now associated with nation states or a political cause before launching attacks against victims that had been, I don't know, probably handpicked or selected because of certain things they said or certain things they have done or certain statements they've made. And that has been quite a few that's going on, especially in Asia Pacific. So because of that, we're seeing the intensity and the targets of these hacktivist attacks starting to shift as well, because they're no longer random. They're kind of, you know, carefully pruned. And most of the time, they're actually related to specific geopolitical events happening either across the region or across the world. And I'll leave with the very last bit in terms of our observation. And I think this is something that everyone is thinking and talking about, which is AI attacks or AI powered attacks. So I think social engineering like phishing attempts remain a highly effective vector for the bad guys because it still works. The only thing that is different right now is people are no longer falling victims to phishing emails asking you to transfer money to a Nigerian prince, something like that. Those are not happening anymore. But instead, we're looking at AI-infused phishing attempts where, you know, voice synthesis or synthesized voice has been used in voice phishing. We're seeing facial synthesis has been used in deepfake videos or AI-generated contents to really make those phishing attempts a lot more convincing as well as sophisticated. Conversely, at the same time, AI is also actively being incorporated at breakneck speed by multiple industries into security technologies that are usually used to enhance threat detection, find anomalies, automate incident response, with the ultimate goal of making security teams more effective as well as more efficient, because they're actually staring down a relentless barrage of, you know, attacks, whether it's conventional or AI powered, or for hacktivist groups that can just appear out of random, you know. So they have a lot to deal with. And basically they are rushing to embrace AI to help them out, hoping that it will actually alleviate some of their symptoms. So hopefully that's able to answer the question, Carissa.
No, that's awesome. That's a lot. And a lot going on as well. And you're right in terms of reduction in the Nigerian prince, but how, you know, AI-infused attacks are sort of coming into the coalface now that we're seeing. And, you know, part of the other people I've interviewed as well are saying that's obviously a massive focus. So in saying that, I want to go back for a moment on ransomware. And I know it can be hard and people are always going to say you don't pay the ransom. But speaking of people on the show historically, they've just said sometimes people just, like, as in security people have actually advised them to pay it because they had no backup or it was too hard. They needed to get up and running because they're a manufacturing company. The more downtime that you have, it really impacts them from a financial perspective and risk to their business as well in terms of like media and PR damage and all that type of stuff. So where does that sort of sit with you, with your experience?
Right. That's always a constant debate going around whether should we pay or should we not pay the ransom. So I think it really comes from different, you know, it depends on where you're looking at this issue. So for example, if, you know, I've come across large enterprises that, you know, that are more financially stable, financially capable, they usually have a higher threshold of risk tolerance. So in other words, they are, I would use the word willing, but they are, you know, more able to write off a certain amount of, I guess, money related to a cybersecurity incident because they have a bigger risk appetite that's able to absorb that. And at the same time, usually large enterprises, they have and can afford pretty comprehensive cyber insurance as well, which, you know, kind of provides them with some kind of remuneration, I guess. And, you know, there are large enterprises I've come across that are, you know, they're willing to pay the ransom because they did, I guess they did some kind of calculation in terms of how much is it going to cost us if we, you know, pay the regulatory fine versus recovering our data versus rebuilding the network versus all the, you know, all the fallout that we're going to clean up compared to paying the ransom. So I've seen enterprises that are pretty hasty actually paying that because they did some math in the background, I guess, that actually gave them the impression that, well, if we pay the ransom and this problem goes away, it actually makes more sense financially and operationally. So there are enterprises that are still paying ransom, unfortunately, even though that, you know, the best practice is not to do so. And that's for large enterprises. When we flip the coin to the other side, when we look at smaller or medium-sized enterprises, they have an even bigger problem because they don't have that large financial capacity as compared to the big enterprise they usually can't afford a very comprehensive cyber insurance. And more importantly, they can't afford downtime because, you know, a lot of these small organizations, their entire livelihood or the business depends on them being online and being operational at all times. So I think this kind of comes to a juncture where to some of those small business owners or medium-sized business owners, they just pay the ransom and, you know, get it done with so that they can move on. And, you know, because of these, we're seeing quite a large difference between industries, between size of companies, between the verticals they're in, between what is considered as core critical to their business. It really varies. But at the same time, right, even though that is the reality, what we've also found out, you know, from working with law enforcement agencies, for example, I'll give you a very good example, is when the Lockbit ransomware group was taken down by a global coordinated asset sometime last year. One of the most interesting things they found, as in the law enforcement agencies, was that for those victims that actually paid Lockbit to decrypt and delete the data that they've stolen, they actually didn't. So what they actually found was that all the data that Lockbit has promised or had promised to delete away after the ransom was paid wasn't. So it was still kind of stored somewhere, stashed away in some vault. We're not really sure for what reason. Could be reused again, maybe on some other days. But what we're seeing is that, you know, it's one thing to pay the ransom, but you're also trusting the crook to keep his or her promise that they have delivered to you. And it's, you know, it's kind of a risky decision. So this is basically two sides of the fence we're looking at. So on one side, we're seeing enterprises trying to keep the faith that by paying, you know, the ransomware groups are going to keep the promise and they will get the data back or the data deleted and business can go on. And on the other side of the fence, we're seeing ransomware groups, you know, doing the complete opposite, even selling the data to other cyber criminals for them to, you know, re-extort the same victim over and over again. So again, from an industry perspective, I think it kind of varies quite a bit. That is the kind of reality that we're seeing at right now.
So I want to shift gears now slightly. And I'm aware that Akamai has developed a defender's guide for 2025. So maybe tell us a little bit more what's in the guide, because then I want to sort of ask you a few more follow-on questions.
Yeah. So we've recently published a defender's guide as part of our State of the Internet Security Research Report, which we release on a cadence every 2 to 3 months every year. So what is different from this one is we're basically taking a break from our traditional security research reports that were more data and insights driven. This time, rather than just providing abstract security trends, the report actually consolidates cutting-edge security analysis from Akamai's security research teams with actionable recommendations that are tailored for first-line defenders like a SOC analyst, for example, enabling them to allocate resources and time more effectively against emerging trends. So some of the highlights from the report include a risk scoring model, a brand new risk scoring model that quantifies vulnerabilities. We also look at specific attack techniques that's been used by sophisticated threat actor groups across the world, including how VPN systems are exploited, as well as how containers in the cloud are being exploited, to the emergence of very evasive malware that continuously adapt to the defenses that's trying to stop them. So this research comes with recommended mitigations, which is really what makes this research so compelling, because we're not just telling people what we found out, we're also telling them that how it could hurt you, and more importantly, what they need to do right now.
And would you say, so you're starting this new report, as you mentioned, you're moving away from your traditional reporting. Would you say, like, if you were to do this again, the end of the year or the start of next year, there's going to be a significant shift in terms of what we're seeing because of how quickly things are evolving, as we know, with AI, like you've mentioned before previously, AI-infused attacks in terms of, you know, voice, etc. Will we start to see the needle move significantly in terms of these attacks, or do you have any sort of insight on that front?
Yeah, I certainly think so. I certainly think that the needle is going to move a little bit this year because of rapid or accelerated adoption of AI into multiple industries and at the same time increasing the inherent risk that AI brings into organizations as well. And because cyber criminals, they are opportunistic, right? They look for weaknesses in, you know, defenses anywhere they can find and then try to exploit them. And because we're just, in my opinion, I think we're kind of still scratching at the surface of what AI can actually bring to the table. We know what Gen AI can do. And I think right now we are bringing that to the next level by venturing into things like agentic AI in terms of delivering real world outcomes that are powered by artificial intelligence. But by doing so, it's actually connecting AI models, which were previously in Gen AI, for example, reserved for content generation, into the real world where it's actually going to plug into different applications, different services, and different systems everywhere. So when that happens, you're going to have a massive mesh of interconnected systems that are powered by artificial intelligence in the back end. And, you know, when you look at it from the lens of a cyber criminal, that is actually very, very alluring and very compelling for them to take a good hard look in terms of where can I exploit this? Because when everything is interconnected together, we're going to see a massive flow of data moving from, you know, not only point A to point B, but basically everywhere at the same time because of the capability of AI doing things in parallel. So because of that, I believe that this year, at some point where we revisit this report again, things are going to shift. Because if we look at how AI is being exploited right now, I think we're going to discover more of that. We're going to see more AI vulnerabilities become more visible. We're going to see some of the shortcomings that organizations will discover when they go full-fledged AI adoption, some of the risks that's going to become more compelling for them to address at some point because regulations are already circling around how AI should be used both ethically as well as securely. So I think at some point this year, when we do this again, we expect to see infusion of AI into the techniques or into the attack techniques as well.
Okay, so Ruben, you mentioned before AI vulnerabilities. So what does this look like? Walk me through it.
If we look at Gen AI today, for example, we're seeing, you know, not only is Gen AI, well, we know what Gen AI can do, but we're also discovering the vulnerabilities of Gen AI. Like, you know, you could actually figure out how to jailbreak it by circumventing its guardrails, basically abusing the AI model to do what it should not be doing, you know, and that's a very real risk right now because everyone is trying to see where the guardrails are and how to break them. And at the same time, we're also seeing, or we know how much AI models like Gen AI depend on data, whether it's training data, whether it's inferencing data, and so on and so forth. So there's a lot of data that's in place that actually influences the outcome of AI models. And that's really an area where if we abuse the data or if we circumvent the data from an angle of integrity, for example, make it becomes less accurate or make it become completely false, then that will be a problem because the AI will be trained on that completely inaccurate data. And then the output generated would similarly become completely inaccurate or even malicious. So these are the things we're seeing today in terms of criminals trying to experiment how to break into AI and circumvent the integrity of the AI model. But again, once this AI model starts to connect with external systems like and tools like APIs, for example, they're actually going out to the real world and talking to real world applications like, you know, a CRM application, a Uber-like application, or anything that can basically commit a transaction on behalf of a human. And when this happens, then you're going to have data that could be moving from a compromised model into an unsuspecting victim application. So it basically opens up new avenues of attack because once again, all these things are interconnected. They're all in a mesh. So it basically allows the bad guys to gain an entry or a foothold into those third party and external systems. So this can actually become quite impactful when executed correctly.
So Ruben, everything that you sort of discussed here already, obviously there's always problems, there's new things coming out all the time. If you were to zoom out, do we, as in we as an industry, vendors, service providers, etc., can we solve all of these problems at the moment? And I know it's like, you know, AI to some degree is relatively new-ish and people have got, you know, more like point solutions to, you know, solve certain problems, but like just there's just so many things that, you know, we were saying before, like, you know, in the API and then, you know, leveraging some of that data, and then there's another problem, another can of worms open. So I'm just always curious to know, like, we're moving faster than we ever have before. So what does this then look like now? Because people were struggling before any of this stuff really started happening. Now it's coming out faster. We don't necessarily have all the answers. I know that there's no silver bullet, but I don't know, help me make sense of that. Because I mean, I've been doing the show for a while, and even in like last 12 months, just the sheer volume of like attacks and the breaches and everything like that. But it's just always curious to know, like, are we even prepared for what's even out there?
Yeah, that's a good one. And to be honest with you, I don't think we will ever be 100% fully prepared, because the landscape is just changing so quickly, so often. What we thought was sufficient today may not be so tomorrow. So, but at the same time, right, we need to understand and we need to be aware of the fact that, you know, innovation, digital innovation in its purest form, whether it's through AI or through APIs or through another disruptive piece of technology, is going to move at a different speed from security or from cybersecurity. Because in the world today, a lot of organizations are led by innovation. They have to reinvent themselves. They need to disrupt their own marketplace. They need to stay ahead. They need to compete. And because of that, innovation usually charges ahead. And there will be situations where, you know, cybersecurity or risk management efforts will need to take a back seat when these things happen. And we've seen this movie many times before, right? Because for example, 10 to 20 years ago, when cloud first came into the scene, it was exactly like that. Because organizations were lured by the perceived cost savings of moving their stuff to the cloud as compared to owning a data center, right? But after them doing so, it took a bit of time before they realized that, oh, I need to be safeguarding my stuff in the cloud because they're exposed to everyone everywhere. And I believe that at some point we will reach there from, you know, if we're looking at AI, we will. But I think right now, people are really looking at how is AI going to help innovate my organization? How is this going to, you know, make me more efficient? How is this going to stem down my cost and increase my top line? This is, you know, this is similar to what has happened 2 decades ago when cloud computing burst into the scene. So the good thing is we've learned our lessons, which is why we're seeing the regulatory bodies stepping in, actually expanding the regulations to incorporate, you know, AI safety and AI ethical use and stuff like that as well. Because of that, the industry is also coming together with both private and public entities to figure out, you know, if we do this, what are the risks? What do we need to address? A good example would be the OWASP's LLM top 10. So OWASP is a nonprofit group that actually lists out the top 10 most vulnerable risks that can be exploited. And they actually released one for LLM, which is for Gen AI. So we, you know, as compared to 20 years ago when cloud first came onto the scene, we're now a little bit more aware. We're now a little bit more on board in terms of, you know, following best practice, following guidelines, establishing regulations, putting in guardrails, and training people, making them more aware. But at the same time, to your point, are we ever going to be prepared if we do this? I don't think so. But that doesn't mean we should stop doing it, because as attacks against AI or as attacks powered by AI continue to increase and continue to evolve, we're actually doing the same thing in stopping attacks. We're embracing AI. We're infusing AI into cybersecurity operations. We're trying to advance our security tools and technologies with AI as well. So it's actually happening at both fronts, which is what's really interesting right now, because I had a conversation with a CIO last year, and he was kind of explaining that, well, in today's context, it's funny because AI is a technology I've not seen in the longest time where we actually use that same piece of tech to both make our business better, but also make our business more risky. So it's, you know, that kind of approach that if you adopt a disruptive piece of tech, it will bring the benefits or perceived benefits. But at the same time, if you flip the coin to the other side, it's also going to bring a certain level of risk some of those that we do not fully understand yet into the organization. So I think from that angle, this is really what we're looking at right now. But I do believe as time goes by, as the usage or the use cases for AI become more mature, as the attacks themselves become something that we understand more about, and more importantly, as our capability of AI-powered cyber defenses continue to evolve over time as well, I think we'll come to a juncture where what we've done with cloud, right? We've basically understood what needs to be protected, where, when, and how, and also keeping an eye out on how that dynamic cybersecurity ecosystem is evolving.
Okay, I want to go into this a little bit more. So when you were talking around, you know, embracing like disruptive tech, for example, and again, like when you're introducing that, there is some risk. Would you say, with how everything's going, like you've just mentioned, that things are faster, everything we've discussed already on this interview, do you think businesses now are just going to have to make decisions quicker than they have? I mean, look at a traditional enterprise. Like sometimes things move so slowly. And by the time people make a decision, it's like, oh, something else has already started anyway. So do you sort of see that from a like a operational point of view that, you know, maybe, yes, we can't do a full-blown like audit and risk and look at it to the nth degree because we just don't have the time on our side? So I don't want to say cut corners, but do you think people will just have to look at how they're approaching everything that's happening, or else, you know, there is that risk that them taking too long could actually then put them at risk of having other issues? And so you have to sort of balance it with which one's worse to have. Do you see that happening?
Yeah, absolutely. So that's really the reason why we've came up with a new risk scoring model, which is really trying to address that particular conundrum that you have just brought up. Because when we look at, you know, trying to secure or trying to safeguard assets in the enterprise and trying to make decisions in terms of what protection needs to go where, by when, and how are we going to protect it, the reality is you can't do that everywhere, every time, to everything. Firstly, it doesn't make sense. Secondly, it's going to take too long. And thirdly, it's going to cost a lot of money, probably infinite amount of money, because you don't know how it's going to cost. What organizations are doing right now or should be doing right now is to really look at, you know, prioritize assets and basically build, for lack of a better term, a ranking system in terms of which are the most critical assets that is too important to fail, right? Without these, the business will fail. These five or these 10 assets, applications, or, you know, whatever you want to call it, appliances, hardware, these must never fail. So we're going to spend 30 or 40% of our time and money to ensuring all these stay up. And in order to understand what those assets are, we need to look at establishing a risk register, which is basically something that the risk scoring model in the report actually helps in building out. So once you understand which are the prioritized assets, yes, you need to make a decision on those, a quick one, but at the same time, you're also getting more visibility in order to make a more informed decision that you're not protecting something that maybe is, you know, lower down in the pecking order from something as compared to a critical system, for example. So once that is set in place, it also, and I was about to talk about this later, but it also gives rise to the organization building resilience into their operations. Because, you know, if we look at maybe they have got like 50 assets in the organization, 50 digital assets, you know, websites, endpoints, web servers, applications, so on and so forth, 50 of those. So if 40 of those go down, can the business still run? Maybe not as quick as before, maybe not as, you know, not as efficient as before, but the question is, can it still run? So if the answer is yes, then these are your critical systems. You need to protect those at all costs. So by doing so, and also building out your recovery capabilities and also building out your fallback capabilities. For example, if your digital is gone, you fall back to manual. How long can you hold out? 6 days, 6 weeks. So once you do that, it all goes back into that risk scoring model. What are those that we need to protect? And if this fails, what do we do then? So once we have a better idea of what that looks like, it's actually the first step into increasing the cyber resilience of your entire operations.
So do you think as well that people just don't like making decisions? And I would caveat that with saying, because like you said, if it fails, then what? So people don't necessarily want to have their name attached to something that fails. So with what you're saying here, Ruben, would you suspect that now people may be slightly apprehensive because, again, like, people don't like making decisions. They don't want to feel like they're potentially their names are getting something that failed. There's all those sort of thoughts that come up for people. So where's your head at with that? Do you think people are not as receptive initially because, again, everything I've just listed before?
Yeah, I think that's kind of human nature. I think what you're referring to is accountability, Carissa. So I think a lot of the situations we've encountered is, yes, there is a human element involved in it that people tend not to want to be accountable when things go sideways. I think that's part of human nature. But at the same time, it doesn't elude the fact that somebody needs to own it, right? Because if nobody owns it, it's going to fail. It's just a matter of time. And how is it going to fail? Which is why if we look at regulations that are evolving, a lot of that are driving accountability of the organization to be accountable to report certain security incidents in a prescribed time window, to be accountable for any loss of data, to be accountable for so on and so forth. So that is from a regulatory perspective down to the organization. So if that happens internally within the organization, they need to drive their own level of accountability within. Because if not, then they're going to violate every single clause in that regulation because no one owns anything. And therefore, nothing gets improved, nothing gets looked at, nothing gets fixed. So I think the core issue here is not really because people don't want to own stuff. I think here is really because people fear stuff will fail, which is really going back to, you know, the idea of resilience. And, you know, I think for the longest time in cybersecurity, and I guess it's really because of a byproduct of, you know, of major successes from security vendors, that the previous concept of cybersecurity was about 100% prevention, meaning I need to stop 100% of the attacks. I need to prevent 100% of data breaches. Therefore, I'm buying this firewall. I'm deploying that endpoint protection. I'm doing what I'm doing, right? I'm hiring a bunch of people to look at log files. But the problem with that is if you look at the amount of attacks we've been getting so far, if you look at the amount of victims in Australia alone, there's fallen victims to cyber attacks, you realize that there's no such thing as 100%, right? Even though it's a holy grail that we all strive to go towards, it is hard. So when that happens, the human nature is, if I can't get 100% and if I'm accountable and if a breach happens, I don't want that, right? I want to step away from that situation. But if we kind of change the mindset a little bit and look at the fact that, look, you're going to get breached anyway. So the question here is whether or not you get breached, but rather, can you contain a breach and keep it to a minimum that you can recover from it quickly? And that's the whole ideology behind resilience. So once we shift the mentality to one that drives cyber resilience, right, and naturally the fear of not being able to hit or get the 100% prevention benchmark is going to fade away. Because when organizations slowly start to embrace the fact that we will get hit, it's a matter of when, it's really what we do when we get hit that really matters right now. So once that happens, I believe that, you know, the measurement or whatever we use to understand whether or not someone is doing his or her job by preventing attacks and shifting that to helping us to contain the breaches and keeping it to a level that we can manage it. So once that happens, I believe that the situation you've mentioned earlier should start to get better.
Okay, so you mentioned before, how quickly can we recover? Now, I know this is going to be maybe slightly hard to answer, but it's more just understanding your thinking, where your mind goes. Where do you sort of see, even if you give it like an industry or like financial services or whatever, obviously that they can't afford to have downtime or else people start arcing up, you know, Twitter starts, you know, people start losing their mind very quickly. So how quickly do you envision companies, just say something happens, can recover and get back up and running like really quickly? We're going to start to see a velocity on that in terms of everything that you're saying, because now what is available, knowledge, etc., capability, technology, even the thinking and the attitude, will that start to become faster now to what we've seen in the past of people taking days, weeks, some people months to recover? What does that look like?
So I think the backend recovery side of the house in technology has certainly improved by leaps and bounds. It has certainly become a lot more advanced as compared in the past. So in the good old days, So for those of the listeners who are as old as me, we'll remember LTO tapes, tape libraries, tape drives. Those backup and recovery would take forever, right? Because back then we were talking about RTO and RP, recovery time objectives, about, I don't know, 5 days, 6 days, meaning we can live without the data in 5 or 6 days back then. But today, in today's context, we can't live without it for 5 to 6 minutes because everything is real time. Everybody wants it right now. And here comes the thing. With the advancements of recovery technology, we're seeing a huge improvement because now we can recover from the cloud that's doing real-time backup and streaming that back into our systems if required. I think that has improved a lot in terms of how we recover. But I don't think that's really the core issue here. I think the core issue is there's a finite time window of how much you can recover in a certain amount of time. So let me give you an example. If a ransomware attack was successful and managed to lock up about 90% of your data in the entire enterprise, and you need the data to fulfill orders in the next 60 minutes, the question to ask is, can I recover 90% of my business data in the next hour so that we can continue to flow and not suffer from disruptions? It's a very big challenge. So instead of trying to, or should I rephrase that? I've actually spoken to people who looked at this before, and some of them were actually quite confident that it's okay if we get hit by ransomware. We've got very, very robust backup recovery facilities. We've got cloud, we've got data centers, we've got nearline, we've got offline, we've got online backups, you know, stuff like that. It's all great. It's all very sophisticated. But the question is, how much of this data can you recover in the shortest time possible? And what is those shortest time we're looking at? Because when ransomware comes in, they're not going to tell you, I'm going to encrypt 30% of your data. I'm going to steal 40% of the rest, and I'm going to just destroy the remaining ones. They're not going to do that. Because when a cyber attack or data breach happens, they're going to come in and their objective is to cause catastrophic damage to your organization. From a ransomware perspective, because their objective is to make you pay. In order to make you pay, they need to make you feel the pain. And when that happens, right, we cannot just fall back to our backup recovery facilities and say, I'm all good, you know, come what may, I've got backup recovery. Which is why we go back to the ideology of being more cyber resilient, because on one hand, it's great if you've got super robust backup recovery, but you also need very, very efficient and effective incident response, because the more effective you are in containing that attack, right, maybe instead of encrypting 80% of the organization, you manage to breach two endpoints because of all the security policies and products you have in place. When that happens and you flip the other side of the coin to backup recovery, oh, this is easy peasy. I can recover two endpoints in like 15 minutes, right? And the business can move on. So the whole idea of resilience is you need to have the both sides of the house in good order. One is to minimize the damage that will be caused, and the other one is to recover whatever that's been damaged in the quickest time possible. And together, these two would actually make the organization become better in terms of adapting to these kind of attacks. Because once again, I just used the example of ransomware. It could be a different attack that doesn't encrypt data. I talked about data breaches that steals data and you don't know. There's nothing to recover because the data is still there, right? It is just stolen by the crooks. So when we look at this in terms of resilience, it opens up a whole new dimension. It's no longer about recovering data that's been destroyed or encrypted anymore. It's about incident response that's trying to contain the amount of data that can be stolen or that can be breached. So when we look at this angle, it's going to be a bit different as we, you know, as time goes by, because organizations are really starting to become more involved or investing more and more into making themselves more cyber resilient.
Yeah, this is interesting. Okay, so in terms of where we're at today, and then just say you come back in 12 months and we say like, hey, Ruben, like, what's changed? Where do you sort of think, and I know you don't have a crystal ball, it's just sort of getting some insight. What do you think sort of happens now with where the industry's going? Everything that you said, everything you discussed here already, what's your sort of predictions for the year and beyond?
Yeah, so look, I think a lot of the chatter now from a, you know, prediction perspective has always been about AI and, you know, AI this and AI that. I agree, AI is going to be very important. AI is going to drive a lot of the fundamental changes that we're seeing right now. But when we look at the lens of, or rather through the lens of a security practitioner, we're still going to see data breaches, a lot of them. It's not going to slow down. We're still going to see a lot of ransomware. It's not going away. In fact, I deem ransomware as the new normal. It is your new malware, right? So after viruses became malware and nobody batted an eyelid, they just learned to live with it. I see ransomware going in that direction. It has become the new normal. We need to live with it and we need to be prepared for it. But I think in the future, in those data breaches, what I think I wouldn't be surprised with is a lot of those data breaches or the cause of those data breaches are still going to be, you know, have the same reason why they were breached, because cybersecurity fundamentals were not practiced. You know, there was no multi-factor authentication, software and hardware were not patched in time. People were basically falling to phishing attacks and not careful with divulging their confidential information and credentials, you know, stuff like that. We're seeing that a lot, or rather we've seen a lot of that last year. You know, very basic fundamental hygiene that were not practiced and resulted in data breaches. And I expect to see those as well this year, because, you know, if history is a teacher, I think we've got some ways to go before we are actually able to overcome this. So I think not only from a prediction perspective, I think organizations really need to take a good hard look into their own cybersecurity hygiene and fundamentals. Because here's one example. The same CIO I spoke to last year, and it was in Australia, by the way, still bring up the topic of the Essential 8, which is basically a set of guidelines that were developed by the Australian Cybersecurity Center, or ACSC, very long ago. So it is, in my opinion, it is pretty outdated because it's way overdue for a refresh, but it's still constantly being brought up in conversations because entities or organizations are still trying to address those very basic fundamental hygiene in the organization. They have to get it right. Because to be honest with you, it doesn't matter if attacks are going to come powered by AI or not, right? It's, you know, cyber hygiene is still going to be table stakes. We need to get these right because we know what the issues are. We know what needs to be done. We just need to get it done.
So Ruben, do you have any sort of closing comments or final thoughts you'd like to leave our audience with today?
Sure. So I think I spoke a lot about cyber resilience and I talked about risk assessments and stuff like that. I think a big part of being resilient, and this is something that, at least from my observation, is no longer reserved for the critical industries. Every commercial entity is looking at resilience, and so should you. I think the important bit about resilience is do not forget intelligence. Do not forget collaboration. You can look at technology, you can look at people, you can look at your business processes. Do not forget collaborating with your like-minded peers in the same industry, collaborating with the public sector. For example, in Australia, the ACSC has what we call the Joint Cybersecurity Centers, JCSC for short, where both private and public entities collaborate on cyber intelligence. Make use of those, because the landscape is always changing. And with AI, it's going to change even faster and even far more dynamic than we initially expected those to be. So look at intelligence, look at collaborating, and, you know, look at the report, like the one in Defender's Guide from Akamai. This basically bring the latest and greatest from our research teams to you and make sure that if you believe you're impacted by what is described in those intelligence reports, learn how to mitigate them quickly. Do not put them away. Do not procrastinate, because the crooks do not wait, as we know. So basically, all this bit by bit would go towards making your organization more resilient in the end.
This is KBCast, the voice of cyber.
Thanks for tuning in. For more industry-leading news and thought-provoking articles, visit kbi.media to get access today.
This episode is brought to you by Mercsec, your smarter route to security talent. Mercsec's executive search has helped enterprise organizations find the right people from around the world since 2012. Their on-demand talent acquisition team helps startups and mid-sized businesses scale faster and more efficiently. Find out more at mercsec.com today.